There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, un poquito de tanta verdad, a little bit of so much truth. I'll be speaking with Jill Friedberg about her documentary film by this name that covers the People's Uprising in Oaxaca in 2006. You will want to stay tuned. The People's Uprising in Oaxaca into a popular assembly in 2006 was an unprecedented popular movement that also made an unprecedented use of media. And I covered many of the stories that came out of Oaxaca during 2006 right here on Media Geek, especially when the people took over radio and television stations. Jill Friedberg was there. And she had experience covering the annual teacher strikes that happened in Oaxaca. And it was the state police's crackdown on the teacher strike which really spurred the popular assembly into action. I spoke with Jill Friedberg recently, and she tells us more about what happened in Oaxaca and what's in her film.
People's takeover and use of radio and television stations as a way to organize, mobilize, and ultimately defend their grassroots struggle for social and economic justice.
And you were down in Oaxaca during the uprising that happened last year?
I was in Oaxaca. I had actually been down there on and off for quite a while between 2003 and 2005, making a previous film called Granito de Arena about the history of the democratic teachers movement in Mexico, which has its strongest base in Oaxaca. So I had been down there for 2 years making that film and had actually premiered that film during a teacher strike in Oaxaca exactly 1 year before the governor of Oaxaca sent his state police in to attack the teacher strike encampment, which is what provoked was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in provoking this popular uprising. So when that happened, I initially went back down to Oaxaca not thinking that I was going down to make another film because nobody really knew what was going to happen with this uprising, to deliver some gear to the teacher's radio station, which had been destroyed in the police attack. And it wasn't until 3,000 women took over the state television station that I realized that another film was actually in the making and that in many ways it was a film about media.
And so you were prepared with your gear?
Yeah, I did. I mean, when I went down to deliver the radio gear, I also took my camera with me, mostly thinking that I was going to probably shoot a little bit of footage that could go into, you know, a short epilogue that I perhaps would add to the DVD of the previous film about the teachers' movement. So I did have all my gear down there. And I also have there's a media collective in Oaxaca called Mal de Ojo TV, and I had been collaborating with some of those folks previously. So there were other people down there who were shooting, who were from Oaxaca, who I ended up collaborating with on this film, but I was also sharing footage with. So that helped.
So you originally went down there to bring aid, to bring help in the form of radio equipment, which the teachers had been using. Mm-hmm. And then kind of found yourself in a situation which you realized needed to be documented.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I had been... in the course of making my previous film, I had actually been working with the teachers as they were getting on the air with their radio station, Radio Plantón, which, while it was a radio station that was created by the teachers' union in Oaxaca, was really a community radio station, unlicensed community radio station. And so, I mean, in some ways, I sort of took it personally when the police destroyed it. But yeah, a lot of folks in the U.S. and Canada actually got together to raise money to replace the equipment that was destroyed. So in a way, I was going down to deliver that. But I did also really want to go down and see what was happening because in my previous film, the film sort of wraps up with teachers in the teachers' movement talking about how they feel like they've become distanced from popular struggles in the state of Oaxaca. And, you know, 1 year later, here was this massive popular uprising with the teachers really at the center of it. And so I also felt like it would be important to go down as a, if nothing else, as a follow-up to my previous film to see how that was unfolding. And then, as I mentioned, it was once this thing really did become a statewide, broad-based popular uprising involving a broad spectrum of different sectors of civil society who were taking over radio and television stations. It wasn't until then that I really realized that another film was in the making and that I had was in the unique position of having already spent a lot of time in Oaxaca and with the teachers' movement. So I had that context and access, but that I also brought to the project not being from Oaxaca, and so I was already sort of in a position to take the experience I already had in Oaxaca to help interpret what was happening in Oaxaca for non-Mexican audiences, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yes, so for Americans, for Canadians, for other Europeans.
Right, especially because in the previous year I had been traveling around to screenings of my previous film, and I was familiar with the kind of questions that audiences in the U.S. and Canada were asking about in their effort to sort of better understand the context in Oaxaca. So I came into this project already knowing what some of the challenges are for non-Mexicans in understanding the political and economic and cultural context there.
Well, what is the difficulty in understanding? What makes it so different or alien to a lot of Americans or Europeans?
Well, boy, that's a tough question. I mean, I think... you know, I think that perhaps one of the biggest differences is in, especially in the U.S., perhaps less so in Canada, but in the U.S., when we talk about, when we talk about a region of the country that is profoundly indigenous, for folks in the U.S., that's really hard to understand because indigenous populations, Native American populations in the U.S. have been so profoundly marginalized and in many ways just made invisible to the majority of civil society, whereas in southern Mexico, you really have an entire region that is indigenous. And when I say that, I'm talking about states like Oaxaca and Chiapas, where the majority of the population still identify as indigenous. Their first language is an indigenous language. Many of those communities continue to practice their traditional forms of indigenous governance and decision-making, and it really shapes society in that part of Mexico. So I think that's one of the first sort of big challenges for folks outside of Mexico to kind of wrap their brains around. And then beyond that, it's just understanding, just like any country really, politics are extremely complicated, and Mexico is no exception to that.
And so what happened then in Oaxaca while you were there, especially with the popular uprising, was, I mean, really unique. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about what happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, the setting is this. There's a teachers' movement in Oaxaca that goes out on strike every year. They've done that for 27 years at least. And they come into the city of Oaxaca and take over the city with a strike encampment and carry out civil disobedience and direct actions to get their demands met, which include salary demands, but also more resources for public education in the state. It's one of the, Oaxaca's the second poorest state in the country, and has and that's reflected in its public education system. But what was unique about 2006 is that they had a governor who'd been in power for a little over a year who almost inarguably entered through fraud, and who, as soon as he became governor, just started sort of breaking all of the rules that existed about how much the ruling party in Oaxaca, the PRI, would be allowed to get away with in the city. I'm talking about a political party that's ruled Oaxaca for 80 years and that has always been sort of a mafia in rural Oaxaca in terms of alliances with landowners and using paramilitary violence to keep to keep communities submissive, but that in the city that there's sort of unspoken rules about how that operates, that mafia operates. And this particular governor came in and just broke all of those rules and was openly spending public money to support his party's presidential candidate, and had social activist leaders arrested, attacked the state's best-selling newspaper, and sent in his state police to attack the striking teachers. And this teachers' movement is considered the backbone of social movements in Oaxaca. And so a large part of civil society in Oaxaca, I think, felt they weren't so much outraged by the fact that he attacked the teachers and didn't come out into the streets so much to defend the teachers. It was more that it was really the straw that broke the camel's back after decades of social and economic injustice and outright racism against indigenous populations in Oaxaca. And I think they also felt like if he's willing to attack the teachers, then he'll stop at nothing, and we need to stop him now. And so this very broad-based popular uprising exploded and across the state and decided to organize itself in an assembly structure, which references the consensus-based indigenous governance that's still practiced in a lot of indigenous communities in Oaxaca, and decided to use widespread nonviolent civil disobedience to demand to render the state ungovernable, which would then oblige the federal government to remove the governor from power. So their demand was that the governor be removed from power, and their tactic was basically shutting down the state. They blockaded every public government building in the capital. They blockaded highways and used a lot of other sort of creative forms of civil disobedience. And they took over radio stations, first in response to the teacher's radio station having been destroyed, and recognizing that they really needed a voice in the a large media outlet that where their voice could be heard, to organize that large sort of statewide acts of civil disobedience. And ultimately, when plainclothes police and paramilitary started coming out in caravans and just opening fire on and attacking peaceful marches and protest encampments, they needed those media outlets really to defend themselves, to use their voices on the air to tell neighborhoods and communities where the paramilitary caravans were operating and how to defend themselves, and to coordinate this unprecedented phenomenon of barricades that went up every night in the city of Oaxaca, which many compared to the Paris Commune, that went up to defend neighborhoods from paramilitary attacks.
And we're listening to an interview with Jill Friedberg, filmmaker, documentarist, discussing her film, Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad, A Little Bit of So Much Truth, about the people's uprising in popular assembly that happened in Oaxaca, Mexico in 2006. And this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. That's where you'll find the Media Geek blog, a frequently updated list and pile of news and views about our media environment, stuff that I don't have time for here on the radio show. And you can get the radio show at radio.mediageek.net. You can subscribe to the podcast, get automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. You can also listen right there in your browser. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. It's now returned to my interview with Jill Friedberg.
And the use of media, and specifically radio, was very important because of the both sort of the geography of Oaxaca and the fact that many people, they're sort of dispersed geographically, and also because these are poor communities. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it was the use of radio and also television, because 3,000 women took over the state television station and operated it, broadcast on it for 3 weeks. Was, first of all, it was logistically critical, as I mentioned, because they were coordinating these massive acts of civil disobedience across the state, and especially in the capital city. Also logistically, because the assembly structure is a horizontal, leaderless, consensus-based decision-making structure, and the occupied radio stations in many ways became the assembly on the air. So the assembly would come to a decision about an action that they were or weren't going to carry out. They would announce it on the radio, and then the phone would start ringing off the hook, and it would be the people of Oaxaca calling in to say, oh, forget it, we're not going to do that, or calling in to say, absolutely, and I'm starting to blockade the you know, such-and-such highway in our community. So it really became the way to take the pulse of what the people of Oaxaca wanted. But the other really important aspect of them having these media outlets in their hands was that for the first time ever, the people of Oaxaca were able to counter the commercial media's version of life in Oaxaca. And I'm talking about the sort of overall, more general version of life in Oaxaca, which completely it leaves out the fact that the majority of the people in Oaxaca live in poverty, subject to severe institutional racism, but then also the commercial media's version of what was happening during this popular uprising, that at the state and national level, the commercial media was saying that this was a small group of radical vandals. They often used the word terrorist, who had taken one of Mexico's favorite tourist destinations and placed it basically under siege, was a term that they liked to use a lot. And for the first time, the people of Oaxaca actually had an opportunity to counter that and to go on the air and say, look at us, we're not violent radicals, we're not terrorists, we're housewives, we're children, we're doctors, we're farmers, and we're not destroying the city, we're demanding justice, and these are the injustices that we've suffered. And people would literally come in to the television and radio stations and go on the air and talk about the injustices that they were living in their communities. And so it had a huge impact in really countering that the commercial media's misinformation and disinformation about the movement.
And when you say they took over a television station, took over a radio station, I think that probably from too many movies, what comes to people's minds is, you know, people, you know, come in armed and right, and ready for a struggle. But that's not exactly what happened.
No, it's not what happened in Oaxaca. And that's probably one of the things that's hardest for people to really wrap their brains around when they think about taking over a building or taking over a media outlet. In the case of the television station, it was several thousand women had taken to the streets in a women's march, and spontaneously at the end of that march decided that they were going to go to the state television station, which their taxes pay for and which has, as its slogan, is called the TV channel of the Oaxacan people. And their decision was, they actually decided to go to the station and ask for an hour of airtime. And they walked into the station. There were at least 3,000 of them. They were unarmed. And they told the manager that they wanted some time on the air, and she told them that wouldn't be possible, and they said, oh, well, in that case, you'll have to step aside because now we're taking over the station. And it wasn't necessary for them to come in, wielding arms or threatening violence. A, there were far more of them than anybody at the station. B, a lot of the people who worked at the station were sympathetic to the movement. But also, I think the third and perhaps most important factor is that there's just a much healthier, more concrete sense of public in Oaxaca and in Mexico in general, of what belongs to the public. And so it was kind of hard to argue with these women when they said, this is our television station, because, in fact, the television station and the airwaves do belong to the people, and people have a much clearer sense of that in Mexico. So the same was the case with the takeover of the radio stations. They were just show up and say, we need some airtime and we'd like you to step aside and we're gonna go on the air. And in some cases they would take over the station for, in the case of the university, it was the university students who took it over and had it for months, whereas with some of the commercial stations they only took them over for a few days and then they gave them back. So it was really, they were being sort of strategic about how long they needed to have to occupy a media outlet, and then they would give it back.
And this was generally a nonviolent struggle. I mean, so not just counting how the TV stations and radio stations were occupied, but on the streets as well, from the standpoint of the Popular Assembly.
Yes, from the standpoint of the Popular Assembly, this was a nonviolent struggle, and perhaps not defined nonviolence, not defined in the sort of purest Gandhian sense of the word, because the Oaxacan people were also very clear about the need to practice self-defense. But their, for example, their most impressive act of self-defense was the erecting of barricades every night. And we're talking about at its peak, for over 2 months, every night, at least 1,000 barricades went up every night all over the city. In some cases, a barricade might have just been a few neighbors and a bonfire and some sticks in the middle of the street that they would lay down so that people couldn't drive through. And in other cases, the barricades that were defending the occupied radio stations would be, you know, 4 or 5 blocks wide in every direction, and they would park trucks across the road and Molotov cocktails and barbed wire stretched across the road. But these were people who were going out in the street, neighbors, knowing that there were truckfuls of paramilitaries driving around with AK-47s opening fire, and they would put their bodies on the line to stand at these barricades just to keep the paramilitary caravans from being able to drive through the city. So that's an act of self-defense that in most cases was entirely nonviolent, and in the cases where those barricades were actually attacked, what the people had to fight back with were rocks, sticks, and Molotov cocktails against pickup trucks and AK-47s or helicopters with police shooting tear gas at them. Another very impressive example was when the federal police entered the city of Oaxaca in the thousands with tanks and machine guns and helicopters. People literally laid their bodies down in the road in front of the tanks, but did not confront the federal police, and in fact didn't confront them until they actually tried to take over the occupied university radio station. And at that point, the people realized that if they lost that radio station, they would lose their ability to organize and defend themselves. And they came out in the thousands in the streets with rocks and Molotov cocktails and sticks and whatever else they could pick up off the street to use, and fought back for the very first time in Mexican history a federal police attack. And again, rocks and sticks against machine guns and tanks, and defended the radio station. So, you know, if you see an image of a bunch of people with throwing rocks and sticks, that doesn't necessarily conjure up especially a U.S. sort of pacifist image of nonviolence. But in the context, it was very much a nonviolent struggle, and the movement was always very clear in disassociating itself from armed resistance groups that have historically existed in southern Mexico.
So in documenting this, did you ever feel yourself in danger, especially for reprisals from the state or the federal authorities?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely reached a point where, I mean, I think the for me and for most people, the greatest perceived source of danger was the plainclothes police and the paramilitaries who were operating under instructions of the state government, because they were not accountable to anybody, and in many cases just sort of loose cannons taking matters into their own hands. And whereas on some level, while the federal police and army in Mexico have a horrific record of human rights abuses, on some level they understand the consequences of, carrying out those human rights abuses against foreigners and against journalists. So there was definitely a constant fear, for example, filming on the barricades at night, that one might be shot or picked up by one of the plainclothes paramilitary caravans. And when the federal police came into town, again, then it was just sort of twofold, because there was this concern of the paramilitaries and then also this concern that one would, that one could be caught in the crossfire when federal police were attacking the movement. There were 23 people who were killed during the 6 months of conflict, all of them Oaxacans with the exception of New York indie media reporter Brad Will, who was killed by the plainclothes paramilitaries that I was talking about when they attacked the barricade on October 27th. At that point, when he was killed, one factor that was also pretty unprecedented in the history of social movements in Mexico was that the government had started its own pirate radio station called Citizen Radio, which had this very fascist discourse, and where people would call in and say, if you see a foreign journalist, kill them, because they had this sense that there were independent and alternative news sources in Oaxaca who were reporting to the rest of the world what was happening. So at that point, it became, whereas being a foreign journalist on some level, you at least like to think gives you a certain advantage or protects you at some, on some level, suddenly it became, you know, all the more reason to be worried for your safety. So the advantage that I had was that I was collaborating with this Oaxacan media collective, and we were able to go out and film together. You know, we sort of had each other's backs, and also they, you know, they're Oaxacan. There were certain neighborhoods that they would say, you know, we're not going to go film there today because it's just too, you know, it's too dangerous for whatever reason. So that was an advantage that I had, that that I wasn't down there entirely working on my own.
And so when did you finish shooting?
I finished, I came home from Oaxaca in mid-December of 2006 and to start editing, and went back down in March of 2007 to get some follow-up interviews. But most of the shooting I finished in December of 2006, and then I finished the film in July of 2007.
And it's now being shown?
Yes, and I'm self-distributing the film, as I've done with my previous two films, Granito Arena and This Is What Democracy Looks Like, because I feel like the best way to get the film, I'd like the film to be used by communities of action and students and universities, to be used as an organizing and mobilizing tool, as a sort of seed for dialogue, and in the case of this film, especially a seed for dialogue about the role that the media play in our own lives and our own social movements and what we want to do about it. And I feel like the best way to get the film into those communities is one really has to self-distribute, because the sort of film festival, PBS distributor route often doesn't get the films into those communities. So the idea is to encourage folks to work with us to set up screenings in their communities, and that's the work that I'm working on now.
It's Jill Friedberg, filmmaker, and the film is Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad, A Little Bit of So Much Truth, about the people's uprising in Oaxaca, Mexico, the popular assembly that happened in 2006, and their unprecedented use of media, radio, and television. If you're interested in seeing the film, it'll be screened in the near future on January 26th at Wooden Shoe Books in Philadelphia. And then on the 26th as well, it'll be in Peterborough, Ontario, that's Canada, at the Market Hill Theater. On the 30th, it'll be in Edmonton, Alberta, at the University of Alberta, and on the 31st of January, at the Koffler Institute in Toronto, Ontario. And you can find out about more screenings and how you could arrange a screening in your area and possibly get a copy of the film at corrugate.org, corrugate.org. That's the home of Corrugated Films, the films by Jill Friedberg. And that brings us just about to a close of this edition of Media Geek. Oh, I think we've got a pretty interesting year ahead of us with new FCC decisions. It hit the wall at the end of December, and a lot of changes afoot. So I think we're going to have some good shows coming up. I hope you'll continue to stay tuned. Of course, I'm always interested in getting your comments. I only get a few, but they've all been very helpful and useful. So do send them along by email, paul@mediageek.net. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont,
and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.